Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, the podcast where we talk about faith, finance, and everyday life in a way that makes total sense. I'm your host, Alexis Busetti. On this podcast, you'll hear the personal stories of friends I'll be interviewing who are doing familiar things in new and innovative ways. We'll answer questions specifically about money and our relationship with it, and we'll explore faith and Bible teaching together. In all of these, it's not about changing our convictions as much as it is about messing with our methods. We'll have a lot of moments here together where we pause, then say, that makes total sense. Hi, I'm Alexis Busetti, and this is That Makes Total Sense. Today, I am bringing you a conversation I had with Sean Dietrich, better known as Sean of the South. Sean is an author. He has an incredibly popular blog, and he also has a podcast. And today we talk about his memoir. This is his most recent book, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? A memoir of learning to believe you're going to be okay. And I just knew I had to try and get Sean on the show because this was one of the most enjoyable memoirs I've ever read. And if you know me in real life, then you know that memoirs are totally my jam. But this was one of the most incredible memoirs I've ever read. It was, of course, well written. Sean is a storyteller, I would say by vocation, he's a storyteller. And so the way in which he communicates his story is incredible. I told Sean that I felt like I got whiplash in the best possible way. I was crying one moment and laughing my head off the next moment. It was incredible. And so we talk about this book, but we also talk about growing up in the South. I could relate to it because of my Bible Belt upbringing. And really, we focus on the healing nature of story. You don't have to be a vocational storyteller like Sean for there to be healing in you telling your own story or us telling our own stories. And so Sean touches on that as well. So I really hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Sean of the South, Sean Dietrich. Hi, everybody. I am Alexis Busetti, and you are listening to That Makes Total Sense. I'm telling you, I love, love, love a good memoir. And sitting in front of me right now is one of the best ones I have read of late. And it is called Will the Circle Be Broken? A Memoir of Learning to Believe You're Gonna Be Okay by Sean Dietrich, Sean of the South. And he's with me today. Hey, Sean.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh my goodness. I'm doing well. It's kind of crazy times right now, but I'm so glad you're with us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no sweat. And you're kind of going through crazy times. Let's just tell everybody in case we get like a, you know, something honks or something like that. What are you guys doing right now, you and your wife?
Well, right now we're in the car on the way to this little tiny animal hospital about three times over, two counties over from us. And because last night while we was having supper, this big smack on our window happened, and my wife and I both heard it, and we stopped eating, and we went outside, and there was this little red-bellied woodpecker that had flown into our window, a fledgling, just a young bird. And we went out there, and Jamie picked it up, and our dinner got cold, and we were just, you know, looking at this little bird. And anyway, it was pretty stunned. We put it into a little box, little shoe box lined with straw. And this morning woke up and it's still alive. It's pretty feisty, but we figured out we have no idea how to feed it.
So we're taking
it to some experts who know how to feed it. So anyway, to make a long story even more tedious and boring, we've named the bird either Woody or Bernice, or what is it, Jamie? Beatrice. We've either named it Woody or Beatrice if it's a girl. So.
Oh my goodness. I love it so much. Well, I mean, I just feel like this is kind of life right now, you know? So that's really sweet. So, you said to make a long story even more tedious and boring, but here's the situation. You are a storyteller. Like,
guilty.
You're a storyteller. And this book, I told you before we started recording, it gave me whiplash in the best possible way, because your storytelling throughout this book, and we'll talk about what it's about in just a minute for everybody, but there were moments when I have tears in my eyes, I'm crying, and then I get to the next paragraph and I like spit out my coffee. Like I'm like just dying laughing. And it's funny because my husband is not very emotional, but he's not super, super expressive. And so there were some of these places where I had dog ears and I'm like, you have to hear this. Like you have to listen to this. And I would read him like some of the funny parts and I can see him like having a straight face. And then he just can't hold it. Like he just can't do it anymore. And he just busted out laughing. So,
Oh my goodness. I need to give you a raise.
That's what my husband always says. He's like, oh, if you know, 20%. I'm like, well, baby, 20% of nothing. We know what that is. So there you go. No, but it's so good. So can you tell us a little bit about, what your book is about? Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
Sure. The book is pretty much just a light retelling of my life. You know, I realized when I started writing it that you really, really got to be brief when you talk about your own life, because there's so much more you want to say. So there's so much not that you know, there's no room to say. So it's a lot more challenging to keep a book shorter than you naturally want to keep it. So it's my life in a nutshell, beginning with when my father committed suicide when I was a boy. So that was the most pivotal part of my life. So that's where the story begins, because the me that I am now is a direct result of that. So I start there and I tell the story going all the way to present day, to the kind of interesting, very, very plain individual that I am now, which I'm proud to be plain and normal, because I like normal things better than I like exceptional things.
Well, I just think if you call yourself normal, I believe you. But it's just a reminder to me that, you know, in Jesus, we're all exceptional, right? Like we all have a place. We all have a story. He gives us all hope. And so I believe you, when you say, you're normal, but I say that sort of
because, growing up the way that I did, which was, you know, I grew up pretty tough. It was a tough life. We were not normal. And all I ever wanted to be was just a regular guy. Just wanted to be just a regular guy. You know, you go to church and all your friends have this degree of normalcy to their lives. And there's such a beauty in being ordinary. So I like being an ordinary guy. But yes, I totally hear what you're saying, and I agree with you completely. But I do feel like a regular guy. It just took me a long time to get here.
Right. No, I love that. And for people who haven't read the book yet, this was you're right. I can hear it in your story when you talk about just wanting to be normal, because how you grew up wasn't normal. I kind of want to start a little bit by saying that I could relate to parts of your story, because of where I grew up. And so you are Sean of the South now, but the first part of your story, I could definitely relate to, because I grew up in Southern Oklahoma, which is not really the South, but it is definitely the buckle of the Bible Belt. And your talk about fellowship halls and church ladies and, you know, your experiences growing up in that space, even in Kansas and some of the other parts before you moved south, I'm like, that is
I was picturing it. Like I was picturing the fellowship hall of the church I grew up in. And I was picturing, you know, all of that stuff. And so while your upbringing and your story is so powerful, but it's also so relatable in that way. And because I'm like, I don't even know where to start. I feel like I have so many notes and so many places to go because I just dog-eared the heck out of your book. But maybe we could start, if you just tell us, like, as a storyteller, I mean, I don't know. Is that what you put when you have to write down, like, occupation? I'm like, a storyteller.
I don't know. I mean, whatever somebody wants to call me is the right thing. I don't really know what I am because I don't really feel like anything. I have a hard time calling myself a writer, even though I've always wanted to be one, because I just don't have that much confidence. But of course I do like to write, and I don't really call myself a storyteller because there are real storytellers out there. And, it's really hard for me to,
well,
to
as
compare myself to them.
As a person who has told his story so well, and I know you blog about it and you've written in columns. Can you just, I don't know, maybe we can start there of like, what is it about telling your story? What happens in you? What do you see happen in others when you're willing to put yourself out there and be vulnerable and share your story? Because there's a story. My grandpa was a storyteller, and some of the stories he told about him were about himself. And then other times he just told just generic stories. But what is it about telling a story about yourself and making yourself vulnerable? What does it do for you as the person who's doing the sharing? But what have you seen it do for people who listen and read and respond to?
Well, telling a story is taking a third person view from your primarily, at least when you're telling a biographical story, from your first person life. Mm. So for me to take a third person view, standing outside myself and talking about the little boy that I was, or talking about the teenager that I was, or even the adult that I am from a more of a, you know, journalistic voice, is really freeing in that it helps you stop personalizing everything that happens to you as the character of the story rather than just you, the person. So looking at it from that angle helps you be a little more objective, and helps me process and unpack the things that I have been through. Helps me see the good things that I didn't notice because I was too busy looking at my cuts and scrapes and trying not to bleed. You know, it helps me probably more than anything look at life itself as a work of art instead of just this thing that's happening that has no meaning. And as a storytelling practice, you get the freedom to get that little piece of artwork, whether it's pretty or not pretty, or whether it's impressionistic or ultra realistic, whatever style of art your life has been painted in, you get to choose the frame. Mm. And building that story helps you choose, do I frame this in a beautiful gold frame? How am I going to look at this story? How am I going to choose to see this story? So that's how I've always felt. Storytelling is kind of a way of accentuating the art, you know, the art of it all.
Wow.
So
that is,
I don't know if that made sense.
Profound. Yeah. Yeah. That's really profound. And I just, in that I hear, you know, you said freedom. In that I hear freedom, I hear healing, I hear perspective. I hear what we can all do, even if we're not writers or storytellers, we can practice that. we can take a step back from our own story and look at it, like you said, in a journalistic point of view. That's amazing. That's beautiful.
Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate you saying it's profound, but I believe that, like you said about your granddaddy, I believe the older generations kind of knew this before we did.
Yeah.
And it was to them just totally natural and normal. And to you and me, it's become very unique now because our culture doesn't really, we don't really do that anymore. You don't really go to somebody's house and see them all sitting on the porch if they're under the age of 40 or even under the age of 60. You don't really hear them telling stories like you would have 40 years ago.
Right.
40 years ago, you would have gone to the porch, you know, in southern Oklahoma where you lived, and you would probably have seen, I could almost bet you, because it was all over America, you would see old men sitting on the porch telling stories about their life.
Right.
And I just love that. And I just like that tradition, and I like to bring it back.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can, but in my own life, I can, you know.
It is. It's profound. It is profound, and you're right. It is how it used to be. And there were stories we used to kind of say in my grandpa's voice. He's passed away now, but we used to say in my grandpa's voice, and we would kind of repeat those stories because, you know, we've heard them, right? Like,
yeah.
We've heard them.
You remember them. You remember the really good ones.
Right.
They stick with you.
Right.
There's something about it.
Right. But now it's reruns have taken the place of that. We'll watch a rerun over and over on TV. Because we've lost the practice of our grandpas telling us this stories and our people telling us the stories. What kind of responses do you hear from people? I can hear your humility, and I'm not asking you to step outside of your humility, but what kinds of responses are you hearing from people who listen to your story and listen to your stories? How is it affecting them to kind of be inside of that culture, at least a little bit, to step inside of that culture of storytelling again?
I don't know. I mean, I don't... You know, I don't really have a message. I don't really have anything to get across. I never really felt like I have. Like when we do, before the, you know, quarantine hit, we were on the road, 85% of the year, going across the Southeast. And I would do these, you know, I did storytelling stuff at like old theaters and various nursing homes. Rotary clubs and wherever they had sandwiches, I would tell these stories, and they kept us busy, real busy. And I had never ever planned on doing this for a living. Nobody grows up and says, you know, I want to be a storyteller. That's not really even a job. It doesn't even you're not going to find that on the U.S. Census Bureau form.
Right.
So I would go and do this, and I really, really got into it. I did not ever expect to do this with my life. I don't really think I'm great at it, but I enjoy it. I really do. But truly what it turns into when you are telling your story, in front of people at least, you are really trying to entertain them. You're not just trying to have anything to get across. I just want them to feel good. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really my only quest in this world is somehow to make people feel good, even if it's just for only about, you know, 5 minutes or however long I'm around them. If I can do that, then I did it. That to me, that's my purpose on the planet, if I have one. So I don't really know, you know, if anything I say makes a difference, but I certainly do know that we have had some fun going around and doing this, we'll have a bluegrass band playing and, you know, everybody's clapping and some guy will jump up and he'll just start buck dancing in the center aisle. And then I'll get up and I'll tell a story and we'll laugh and everybody knows a church lady in their life that I talk about. Everybody has one. Everybody can relate to funeral potato casserole, you know, and fried chicken. And I find out that we're all a whole lot more the same than I ever thought we were. So if anybody gets anything out of the storytelling, it's me. I figure out that we're all more alike than I thought. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
I love it. No, it's good. I mean, can I ask you to tell the story? I know Jamie's with you. Will she mind? Can I ask you to tell the story of how you guys met at that fellowship hall?
Yeah. To keep it short, basically, our church did these cover dish socials. It was a thing. And so, for me, food has always been extremely important, and ain't nothing better than church food.
Right.
I love it when the little old ladies get together and give you their best. So, we all were at this Wednesday night covered dish social, and I heard her before I met her. I could hear her across the room. She's got the loudest voice, or had the loudest voice out of that entire congregation. She's a loud talking woman, and she gets it naturally. Her aunts are loud. Her daddy is loud. She is a loud woman, and it's not easy to hide. In fact, not long ago, we were doing a show in Milton, and when the people were filing into the seats and stuff and the band was playing, there was a guy in the audience who called one of the ushers down and said, "Hey, can you get that lady right there in front of me to stop? You know, this show's about to start. Can you get her to shut up?" And the usher said, "Sir, if you want to tell her to shut up, that's on you, but that's Sean's wife." So that's my wife. So I heard her speaking, and I heard her before I saw her. And anyway, we really hit it off. And instead of going through any of the dance or motions, we just fell into each other's company right away. From that first moment when our hands were greasy, eating all that greasy food, and we just touched elbows instead of anything else, it just worked. So I remember when she told me to go and refill her tea without even knowing me or knowing my name even all the way and knowing who I was, and she just hands me her red Solo cup and says, "Go get me some more tea." I knew then that that she would probably be the president of my life.
I love it. It's my favorite, but it is, you're right. We have, everybody's been to a church social. Everybody's drank out of those red Solo cups and eaten the fried chicken. And I love that. I've got one more, one more story that it just really stuck out to me when I was reading your book. I mean, lots of them did. Like I said, I dog-eared quite a bit of it. But that was a very normal thing, to kind of go back to what you were talking about. That was a very normal situation. But to go back further after your dad died, and before and after that, when your life wasn't normal and you just wanted it to be normal, and you were you guys had moved and you were helping your mom, and one of the things that was not normal about your life at that time is you were having night terrors. And you say in the book, you tell about a situation in the book where you're having night terrors and you turned on the TV and there was a televangelist on at 3 o'clock in the morning or something crazy like that. And I just wrote down the note, God sees you. Can you tell us about that moment and what shifted and changed in your life? How old were you and what was going on and what happened in the aftermath of that?
Well, I don't know exactly how old I was, but I was a boy, and night terrors are something I still have. You know, you go through trauma and you don't ever, it makes a, you know, an imprint, a paw print in the cement of your mind that's forming. And, but the only time you can really, you know, you spend most of your life holding these thoughts back so that you can function in daily life. You know, we went through trauma with my father and what he put us through before he passed. And it was traumatic for me, my mother, and my sister. So we all kind of had this, but in daily life, you push that back so that it's not there so you can function. And then at night, your restraints kind of slack. They loosen up because you're sleeping. I mean, this is what a therapist once told me. I didn't make this up. And all these thoughts that you have and all these fears and the after effects of the trauma, they kind of just come out to play. And for some reason, it's worse when you're dehydrated. Don't even ask me how that works, but it is. So the doctor's saying, you know, make sure you drink plenty of water. It'll help with those. So anyway, I've struggled with those for a long time. And I would have these night terrors that keep me up, just horrible dreams, to the point where I kind of got used to them. And when I didn't have them, it was weird. You know, it was just, I was used to having something. And when they didn't happen, it just felt like, that's bizarre. Well, I think it was about, you know, when I wrote that story that you just said, that one night, I think that might have been a turning point for me to realize that they weren't a bad thing. You know, the night terrors were not a bad thing. It was pus and infection working its way out of myself, of my life. You know, there's so many thoughts and feelings that people in my family or people who've gone through trauma are afraid to touch. They're afraid to talk about. They're afraid to mention. They're afraid to think about because of the pain that they'll bring, so they don't. And a lot of people, even worse, and I don't mean this to sound critical, but a lot of people that I know, you know, in heavy religious environments will use religious speech to mask that, and they'll explain it away, and they'll say, you know, but this is not how we're supposed to be, and we've not been given this spirit of fear and blah, blah, blah. And they'll use it to hide behind,
right,
instead of just letting it come out, which I feel like is the most healthy. So I think perhaps that lady on the phone, and even to some degree that greasy-haired televangelist, inadvertently let me know that it's okay. Let them out. Let those fears come out and dance around. Let that pus and infection that's been building up in that sore in your mind start to drain, because that's the only way you can heal. So the night terrors, the more I quit trying to resist them, the less frequently I started to have them. And now I don't have them hardly at all. I still have them, but I don't really hardly have them at all like I used to. And when I do nowadays, they don't even bother me. They don't even do anything to me. That's just kind of a remnant. They're almost, in some bizarre way, they're almost nostalgic.
Wow.
Like, wow. I have a bad dream and I wake up and I remember the kid I used to be and the dreams I used to have.
Mm.
And I think of how far I've been allowed to come. So.
Wow. That's powerful. That's really powerful. Because it is, I agree with you. It's like the stuff that's coming out that needs to be let out, and you don't have to be afraid of that happening, but that happening is important.
Yes, I agree. I think, you know, not trying to hide is been a big theme of my life. Not trying to avoid, not trying to, you know, being vulnerable and talking about things that are not easy to talk about has not been the pattern in my family. So when I talk about them and opening up that, you know, dialogue, I guess you'd call it, has brought a big change in our lives and in my personal life. Just being able to talk about it, it desensitizes you to it at first, and it helps you. I don't know. It helps you.
Wow, that's really good. And there are parts of your book. I love how you tell your story, and you say that exactly what you just said, that this hasn't always been a part of who you guys are as a family, but this has to have had reaching effects positively for your mom and your sister. And you were so respectful and kind and honoring in the way that you tell your story to all of your family, including to your dad and to his memory. But tell us a little bit about your mom and your sister and the strength that they brought to you, and I don't know, maybe this, and maybe some of the ways that you share your strength with them too.
About my mother and sister, you say?
Yep.
Okay. Well, we were kind of like, a wounded family unit, and so you kind of hole up together in a very weird way when you go through what we went through. So, you know, the day after he passed, we were all sleeping in the same bedroom with furniture piled against the doors. That's the fear that we were experiencing. It was pretty strong. So the only people we had to lean on were each other. And my sister was afraid to sleep by herself for a long time, so I slept at the foot of her bed so that she didn't have to sleep alone until I was a grown man. Fear became a huge, huge piece of our life. And it showed itself in all sorts of different ways. Well, when you're afraid, nothing helps like having somebody to be afraid with. It's really true. I know they say misery loves company, but so do frightened people. And we had each other to commiserate with, and that helps me. I hear stories from foster kids who've had to go through their traumas alone, and I have no idea how they would do it. I have no idea how anybody could get through it alone. The horrid things that have happened to some kids that I have met personally and watched them kind of try to find their own way in life when they're confused and they don't have the parental figure, they don't have the stable family unit that everybody else seems to have around you, and then they get through it alone. It's amazing. So my mother and my sister, throughout all our flaws, because we all have a lot of them, me and my mother and sister have probably more flaws than your family. we leaned on each other and we survived. And there's a bond there that is hard to explain. It doesn't look like everybody else's healthy family bond necessarily, but it's there nonetheless.
When you're talking about that, I used to be a state social worker, and I worked with foster kids. This was before we had children. That was what I did, and it was convenient that we had kids because I burned out of that job pretty quick because of what you're saying. But we also have an adopted son. We have four kids, and one of them is adopted. And before he came home, even though I had been a social worker, I was reading every resource I possibly could get my hands on about adoption and trauma in children and things like that. Because even our son came home as a toddler, but even when, you know, kids come home as babies, there's still loss in their story. Just, you know, there's loss in your story. There's loss in my story. And there's loss in our son's story. And that's part of our job as a parent, to help him deal with his loss, but also to grieve with him and to carry some of that with him, because that's his story, that he had a different family and one that he was born into, and now he has us. But one of the authors that I have read talks about children from hard places. And in a way, in a sense, I feel like we're all children from hard places, but she talks about children from hard places and what a difference. She uses this term, felt safety. And she says, because you can know as a parent that your child is safe, and you can tell your child he or she is safe, but until that child internalizes that fact in a very personal and profound way, they won't feel safe. And until they feel safe, they will have a very hard time trusting and healing from, you know, trusting anyone really, and healing from any of the trauma that they have experienced. And I bring that up because I'm talking to you on a podcast after I read your book, and I'm thinking there had to be a point though, where, and it probably wasn't one singular point, but where you personally moved from fear to feeling safe, enough to trust, to feeling safe enough to heal, to feeling safe enough to tell your story, you know, to feeling safe enough to go to college and write and blog and be a journalist and all of those things. And so I don't know if it's necessarily a question, but can you tell us, I mean, I don't know that there was a defining point maybe, but could you tell us a recognition? Did you have a recognition from feeling fearful most of the time to when you started feeling safe?
I mean, that's a good question. It's kind of more like a road trip, without state lines and county lines and road signs. It's kind of like, well, the landscape has changed a little bit. I'm not real sure which state I'm in. Am I, you know, it's kind of like, yes, in many ways it has. There were points where I would look back and I would say, oh, wow, you know, I'm not nearly as afraid as I used to be. But kind of the funny thing when people write a book like this, there's a tendency for some people to say, oh, okay, well, you know, he's got it. He's figured it out. Mm-hmm. He's better now, and he's this. And the truth is, I'm not. And I tried to communicate that too in the book. I feel just as feeble and weak now as I ever did. I realize in certain situations now that I have learned some things, and that I feel less afraid. But I am just the same weak little boy, only now I shave. So I don't know. I don't really know how totally to answer that. There are moments when I think I've come so far, and then there are moments when I think to myself, "You are just a kid." So I would say it's a daily thing that I'm always thinking about. I'm always thinking about how not to feed into certain unhealthy behaviors, how not to feed into certain patterns of thinking that I've grown up with. You know, confidence is a big one. I didn't grow up with a whole lot of confidence, and you can't really manufacture that stuff. And once you've lost a little bit that you did have, you really can't get it back either. You can always feel situationally proud, but never really as confident as someone who was born with confidence, who was given confidence, because it's a gift. I think confidence is a gift your parents give you. You can never really duel that with somebody. So that's one thing I'm always having to remind myself, you know, to not behave in a way that is so self-effacingly underconfident that you shoot yourself in the foot. You know, that's just one example. So I don't know. I feel like I've come a long way in my life, but I certainly have a long way to go. I think my highest aspiration in life is to be an old man one day.
Right. I loved that. That was something that really pierced me when you said that.
I do. I just want to see old age. That's it. And if I can do that, I'm happy. I'm happy now.
Oh, well, I love it.
That is one thing I'll say. You know, there's one thing that I am now that I wasn't then, that I haven't been until this stage of my life. And that's glad. I don't want to say that I'm happy. Happiness is kind of a illusion that people chase, and they look at it like a light switch, like you either are or you aren't. I don't know. I think there's degrees of it. And I don't think unbridled happiness is necessarily the greatest way either, because there's always a flip side to everything. If you're unbridled, happiness is just, you know, is just the biggest thing in your life. Well, there's always going to be a day that it's not there, you know, and then when that happens, how far are we? How bad will that suck?
Right.
Well, this stage of my life, though, I'm really glad. And I've never been that way before. I feel content. I really do. I'm not striving for anything. This is the first time in my life that's ever been the case. I don't know how that happened, but I'm there. And I hope to stay at least in that little pocket for as long as I can.
Man, that's amazing. I love it. I love it. And I think those are two aspirations I would steal from you. I just want to be an old lady. I want to be an old church lady, like my grandma.
Yeah.
I want to be an old church lady with my sticker on my Corningware and getting back my dish after somebody devours my mashed potatoes. I want to be an old church lady. But
I'm with you.
To be in a place where you're not striving and just glad. That's so good. Well, when you're glad and you're not striving and you're not on the road right now, because of COVID, besides the book, which I'm going to link in the episode notes and just keep pushing it because it's just so good. Where else can people find you?
Oh boy. I'm not very good with promotion, so I guess just Google my name, because there's a lot of junk out there with my name on it. I'm easy to find, that's for sure. I guess just look me up and tell anybody who's reading this to drop me a line if they want. I love to talk to people. I can't always respond to every email because we get a lot, but I do love to meet new people. So.
Well, I'll Google your name and I'll put all the links that I find that I think are super relevant in the podcast.
There you go.
How about that?
That'll work.
Okay. That sounds excellent. And I don't want to keep you too much longer since you are probably getting close to taking that bird, but is there anything that you want to say that you wish I would have asked that you want to leave people with, whether it's related to your book or not, whether it's related to this time that we're living in? Is there anything else that you want to say that you wish we could have talked about?
I think we covered a lot. You know, when it comes to the times we're living in, I would say to anybody listening, just try not to watch the news as much as you can. And try to eat good food and laugh a whole lot, because good Lord, this has really been harder than I thought it would be. It started off for us kind of easy. We were in a hotel, and I think Huntsville, when we first saw the news reports about it, on the road for this book tour. And then in like 4 days, everything was canceled. We had, you know, we had a whole 21 days of visiting cities, and everything was canceled. Next thing you know, we're back home. And so that was like 75 days ago. And over time, it's gotten tough. And I feel like a fool complaining, because I'm healthy and happy, but it really does take a toll on your mental health. So I hope, I'm a big proponent of laughing and trying to keep yourself mentally healthy.
Right.
So I don't know if that qualifies as advice, because I don't really give good advice, but.
Right. But pay attention. Pay attention to the mental health situation.
Yeah.
Like you said, I mean, I feel like storytelling is therapy in a way. It's healing.
Definitely.
And it gives freedom. And so that's good. That's good. Thank you so much, Sean, for your time.
Thank you,
Jamie, for being with us and driving while we're chatting.
Yes.
You know, the best to what was it, Woody or Beatrice or whoever fell into.
Oh, Beatrice or Woody, whatever we find out, whatever the sex of the bird is, we will.
Right. Well, our best to the bird. Thank you so much, Sean, for coming on. Thanks for sharing your heart, and thanks for sharing
my
your
pleasure.
Book and your story with us. All right.
It's been a real privilege. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sean. So thank you again so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Share the link with your friends. You can visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com. And until next time, this is Alexis Busetti, remembering to do well for ourselves so we can do good for others. Bye.